Al cabello.
Sir, there's a multi-legged creature crawling on your shoulder.
Thank you for downloading Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am the host, Terry Seven, and I'm joined, as always, by Derek Nine.
Hello.
And Graham, 3.14159263559.
Pie.
I didn't get that right anyway, by the way, just so pie nerds go, that's not right, he's read it out wrong. And you're right, I did read it out wrong. I was under pressure, sorry about that. But why are we using numbers as surnames, guys?
Well, we're either talking about the Borg, or we're talking about A Taste of Armageddon.
Yes, because they use...
Pie.
They use, yeah.
Armageddon pie.
Armageddon pie.
Yeah.
See, they didn't use them against the Borg, did they?
No.
That would have worked. That would have worked. In this episode, Taste of Armageddon, they use numbers of surnames, don't they? Unknown 7, Mayor 3. There's one other guy in there, the blonde fellow who hardly has any dialogue.
Yeah, it's a bit irksome, isn't it?
Do you not like it?
No, because the thing is
it's not real.
I know it's not real.
Your name, your second name isn't suddenly Nine.
Nine.
It's okay,
yeah.
Relax. And if you wanted to use it to a number, you can choose your own number. Okay. It's not a problem.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just a device in order to introduce the podcast.
Yeah, but they've only got single digits. That's the thing that gets me.
Mm. Well, those ones only have single digits. Maybe so, there are others that have... How does it work?
I don't know. By the way, Gary Seven an Eminian then?
Well, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, I wonder. Oh, maybe actually in the universe, it's actually more common to use numbers than it is to use surnames. Maybe with a kind of, you know, backwards kind of... Oh, get them with the surnames. They think they're up themselves,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, still single digits.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, you have to worry about it. It's a bit like whales, isn't it? I mean, like, you're only going to have like what nine surnames, aren't you?
Well, that's true. Or I mean, in Iceland, isn't it? That they don't have surnames at all. They just say who they're their son and daughter of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something to think.
Something to think about. Yeah. Of course. Yeah, we're talking about A Taste of Armageddon.
Yeah.
And this is an episode from the first series. It was originally due to be filmed and produced before Space Seed, but there were script problems, and it had to be moved, bumped up, as Space Seed came in and was produced before it. But the production numbers are different.
Mm.
They retain the production numbers, so it looks like it was made before Space Seed, but actually it wasn't.
Wow!
It was only actually discovered fairly recently that was actually the case.
Mm.
Amazingly enough,
a bit nerds were up in arms about that, weren't they?
I reckon that there was some discussion on various forums.
Has it actually seeped through? I mean, like, I know, I think
has it caused a split?
DVD collections. DVD collections are sometimes done in production order or screening order.
Oh, yeah, I wonder.
So I wonder how...
Well, my DVD collection, I think Space Seed is before... I don't know, actually. I'm not going to go over there and find out. Because apparently I've got a 2000, one from 2000, and it takes at least 10 minutes to open the thing up.
Yeah, it's actually before in the remastered...
Right, sort of, is it?
Which came out quite a few years ago anyway.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. Mm. Yeah, okay. Anyway, all right, so the premise of this episode is Kirk and the Enterprise have to go to Amenia 7 to conclude, or even to get underway a trade deal, a trade negotiation. Something that we here in this country will know something about fairly soon.
Well, we're going to have to do a lot of that.
Well, who knows? Maybe Kirk shows us a way in this enterprise. He's accompanied by Robert Fox, an ambassador, and Robert Fox insists that they orbit the planet and land on the planet, despite warnings from the planet side saying that they're at war, you can't approach, you could be killed, don't do it. And Ambassador Fox says, no, let's go. And they go down there and they discover that these two planets, Vendikar and Emenia, have been at war for 500 years and they use computers to determine the outcome of their war. So, Graham, one assumes that once this whole matter was concluded and they and Armenia joined the Federation, that they were relied upon heavily in the gaming sectors of the United Federation of Planets. I imagine the game engines that they develop would be quite impressive.
Well, I wonder who would have been first to join. Would it have been the Armenians or the Vendicarians?
Yes.
We don't know that, because we never meet a Vendicarian,
no,
do we?
No, we don't.
So we assume they're going to be just like the Armenians, because they are colonists of the Armenians.
Yeah,
aren't they?
That's right.
No, it's not the other way around. No,
it's
the,
it is colonists, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
They're the colonists, aren't they? And Armenia is the home country.
Yeah, I think that. Or at least that's certainly the way the Armenian story tells it.
Yeah, that's the way the story is.
Vendicarians will almost certainly have a different view. Yeah. It's never divulged what they went to war about.
No.
And
no.
I don't know whether or not that was deliberate or not, they just never got around to
maybe it. Was, maybe it's due to the production schedule of the space.
Yeah, it could have been.
It could have been.
It could have been.
Something lost in the midst of time.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see. It always is interesting to see whether or not the original scripts of these things are lying around somewhere, but you suspect they're probably not. They might be in someone's personal effect somewhere.
Of course, the thing is that why they're at war isn't important. The most important thing for the episode is just the fact they are at war, and the way that it's actually a virtual war apart from the death. So it's war without the destruction, isn't it?
Yeah. But there is death.
Yeah.
Extraordinary death.
Well, the amount of people that get killed per year, between 1 million and 3 million.
Yes.
Which is a staggering amount.
And they do it by committing suicide.
Yeah, it is. It is a staggering amount. I don't know what the actual figures from contemporary figures for our times and our planet are for numbers of war dead per year, if you average it out over a century.
I doubt it would be as much as that at all.
No, yeah. I mean, I suppose if you think
when you say ours, you mean ours Britain or ours the rest of the world?
No, the whole world.
If you're talking about Africa, you're talking about Congo. Yeah. I mean, you're talking millions of people who died and continue, in fact, to die in those wars. So you might be surprised.
Mm.
It might well even out like that. It's pretty frightening what goes on. If areas of the planet which are largely unreported in Western media, that some pretty horrible things are going on.
If we say that their planet has a population of a similar population to ours, 6 billion, 7 billion, and you're saying 3 million are losing their lives a year, then that's what, one every 2,000 person is going to be dying.
Over 500 years.
Yeah, over 500 years, but over a lifetime, you've got like 1 in 2,000. You've got a 1 in perhaps 30 chance of dying. Through
1 in 30 chance.
That is staggering.
I don't like those odds.
Those odds are pretty awful, isn't it?
That's more than Logan's Run.
But
that's more than Logan's Run. Yeah.
You're 15 times more likely to die of cancer than you are of being dying in a disintegration machine.
Really?
Well, you don't know that, in fairness, because they may well have cured cancer.
Ooh, well,
one of the reasons why
that's maybe why they're making people go to the disintegration machine. They're living too long, and their health service can't. And maybe their pensions are just fucked up, and they just can't.
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. They just keep this war going.
Wouldn't that have been great if a non-7 had actually said some? Because at the end of it,
I think you're
permanent
you're
war.
Arrived something
there. Permanent war economy. That's what we've got.
The thing is, I'm actually worried now that if any sort of the government at the moment actually listens to this, this would give them some interesting justification.
Theresa May listens to Whom Pods Destroy. It's a fact.
You know, Boris Johnson would be even
worse. My Lord. Well, she wants to, because let's face it, Kirk goes in completely Theresa May mode.
He hasn't got the slightest idea what's going to happen. He just goes and gets out his favour and goes, there you go, right. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of this episode. It's directed by Joseph Pevney, who's directed a large number of TOS episodes, including
Mirror Mirror,
we do definitely know, and a number
Spock's
of others.
Spock's Brain, is it?
Spock's Brain, yes. Was he the Spock's Brain guy?
Yes.
But, I mean, a lot. Some good, some not so good.
Yeah.
Written by Robert Hamner. A co-written teleplay with him and Gene Coon.
Yeah.
And he does have a kind of Gene Coon-ness about it, do you not think?
Yeah.
I think Gene Coon's sort of like all the way through first series.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Robert Hamner, I don't know.
Robert Hamner was a very well-established screenwriter of television drama.
Right.
Mostly procedurals. Okay. Interestingly enough. Okay. But I think that that's interesting because, I mean, he's come up, if indeed it's based on his story, he's come up with what I would consider to be a pretty hard sci-fi concept.
Mm.
I mean, it wouldn't be out the idea of a society getting itself into a state where it thinks that walking into disintegration chambers in order to preserve its culture is a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a pretty hard sci-fi concept.
Mm. Yes. This is pure sci-fi.
Ellison or an Asimov or a Sturgeon short story at all. It's a nice.
I know we've played around with statistics already, but apparently I read somewhere that the seed of this of the idea came off the sort of the casualty lists that were being published on. News programs every night during the Vietnam War, and this is obviously
I read that somewhere as well.
We go back on a lot when discussing these episodes, and so it's that sort of thing of the culture of the time seeping through into the writing
culture. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end, Kirk's pretty much his last words are,
"And actual war is a very messy business. Very, very messy business."
He's almost talking to the camera when he says this. Mm. I mean, he is speaking to the people at home, many of whom are easily old enough to remember the Second World War and who have sons of Vietnam at the time.
It was only sort of 20-odd years, just under 30 years since the end of World War II. Mm.
And you've had Korea in the middle as well.
Which was a big... Yeah. And halfway through the Cold War, which obviously there's a lot of stuff going through there about Russia with the hydrogen, the arms race that was going on anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so war was a part of life, for the majority of people. Mm.
Let's have a quick talk about the map painting.
Yes.
The map painting, because it's another Albert Whitlock map painting. Oh yeah, of course.
An interactive one as well, because it's got the characters.
Did you have a look at the remastered one?
No. I've only seen the original.
It's the final episode in which they have embedded characters in the map painting. Yeah. Any subsequent ones they didn't have. Derek's got a picture of it here, which we won't show to listeners because they can't see. But here, look at that.
Yes.
You saw that. Yeah, that's right. Because you've got in the foreground, you've got the actors. It's very similar. It's very faithful, the remastered one, but it has a monorail ride coming across, which is really, and a few more extras around as well. Walking around, which actually, this is the first occasion in which I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know whether I prefer it to Whitlock's original. I don't think that's important, but it is. I think it's very faithful.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure about the Devil in the Dark one. But I mean, this one I really like. I think it's really nice.
Yeah.
That's in terms of the remastering. There's not much else to go on. Because it's mostly done in presumably redressed corridors of the Enterprise. Is by the looks of things, mm-hmm. is what the sets look like.
Well, that's it. Using different lights, for the sets and stuff like that.
Yeah. I also noticed, however, that they were when Kirk and the landing party went in to meet the council and to meet a nun for the first time, that the guards had to open the doors. I mean, they've come this far, they can't figure it. I mean, like, take a leaf out of your book from the Organians, mate. Come on, figure it out. You can do it. The only other thing for the remasters is that there's some very nice flybys of the Enterprise.
Right.
They just think, well, there's not much else to do here, so we'll just create some nice new flybys of the Enterprise, the old and original Enterprise, which is always welcome. So lovely close-ups, you get some nice detail. And it's always welcome to see that because it's a lovely ship, the Enterprise. Let's talk a little bit about Anan Seven then.
Yeah, he's a duplicitous character, isn't he?
I mean, he's great. One of my favourite scenes in this is when Kirk breaks into his room, his quarters, his room, and threatens him with a gun. And Anon is, you can see why he's the head of the council.
Mm.
Nerves of steel,
absolute
ice in his veins. And quite happy.
You know who he reminds me of there?
Who's that?
John Colicos in this.
Oh, mate, of course.
His performance is very, very similar in that. Because it is very much... That's a lovely picture from the photo novel there.
There is this great picture.
Yes, of him in action. But yes. I think he is. And this got me to think, because like all the props that they're using down there and the outfits they're in, they're all a bit Klingon.
Do you think so?
Yeah. And do you know what? It is, and I know it's the costumes and the props there only because it's cheap and to reuse and you know mm-hmm. and more effective to reuse, but the way it sort of presents itself is it is very much that this is almost like an offshoot of the Klingon race. Now this is my hot take.
This is your sizzling take.
This is my sizzling take. You know, like the Romulans and the Vulcans split.
Yes.
And so the warlike ones went off. And the logical ones went off in a different direction. So what if the Klingons had a similar thing, where the ones who eschewed the battle and war had this came up with this idea of virtual wars, and they let all the other warriors like go and. Here you go, here's some fast ships, go away and take over the rest of the year.
So these are the Armenians are offshoots from the Klingon race who acknowledged their warlike spirit.
Yeah.
Because and Anunsevan makes that explicit in his justification towards the end when Kirk is in the process of ending this whole thing, of going, look, no, this is what we do, we kill.
There can be no peace. Don't you see we've admitted it to ourselves? We're a killer species. It's instinctive. It's the same with you.
And but we've tempered this
by.
I wonder if they have holodecks as well there to kind of temper their. Maybe they've developed holodecks earlier.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
They're clearly well into their AI though, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's a society based largely upon AI, very very ordered.
Very ordered. Very,
very utopian by the looks of things.
Very very fascist as well. They follow orders.
Very fascist.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Extremely
strong
fascist.
Sense of duty.
Yeah.
And also the sort of the population seems to be very meek, because the thing is when Kirk and his crew sort of start blowing up the destructor booths or whatever they are, the suicide booths, all the people that are just hanging around, they just sort of meekly walk off. There's no sort of screaming and running around.
They're using very very poor extras, but the funniest thing I spotted was in obviously the moment of light relief in this when Spock does his very famous you have a multi-legged creature on your shoulder.
Yes,
there is another guard walking along right behind Spock. Full view of what's going on, going la 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 la. Oh, look, just take that card. Not interested.
These
at all.
Guys are not encouraged to take the initiative.
No,
but then
not.
You know that's because they know that at any time they could be asked to walk into a room that has no exit. So I mean, it doesn't
what
make
for a scarf.
I mean, it's. I mean, I've said utopian. And I mean in terms of the appearance, largely just on the basis of the Albert Whitlock map painting. But this is a grisly society.
It is. I mean,
seriously
dystopian. Computer room.
Yeah.
The whole thing is run by three old mainframes.
And look, here we go. And I've just flicked the switch. So if you just zap it with your ray gun, it's all over. Yeah. I mean, we can forgive that because, frankly, you know, it's much more exciting.
Basically,
than...
Basically, if it's a utopia, they're just drugged up to the eyeballs, everyone. Mm. It's just like Brave New World, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an oldest Huxley sort of story.
Yeah. It's Logan's Run, isn't it? Yeah,
yes.
Isn't it? It's that sort of idea as well.
Yeah, no, it is.
You live in a paradise, but, you know, once you go...
There's a huge, massive payoff, massive trade-off.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that you're saying, that, I mean, this is going back to the actual sort of story. The thing is that the society is actually more important than the life of
than the people
there,
yeah,
which is really interesting. And when it's brought up, supposedly Anon Seven,
but yes. I think that they tend to pronounce it Anon, but the characters spell A-N-A-N, okay. So but yeah. I mean, whatever you want to,
we
know who you mean.
Anon Seven, I mean, he's going on about sort of the civilization.
Mm.
And seem very civil to Kirk and everything, who he calls him, you know, calls him a barbarian, you know.
Well, it's interesting, actually. If you look at it if you take a contemporary situation now, is that all the fighting in Syria is, you know, it gets lots and lots of coverage, but it doesn't pique interest as much as say the blowing up of some antiquity relic from in Palmyra or something like that.
Yeah.
So that almost grabs more attention than tens of thousands of people being, you know,
and a society obsessed with its culture, obsessed with its culture, and willing to die to preserve it.
Yeah.
And willing and happy to watch others die.
Mm.
So not just prepared to sacrifice yourself, but actually also willing to let others die, prepared to kill.
Mm.
And it's one thing to prepare to die for your beliefs. It's another to be prepared to kill for what you believe. Well, these people are, and the Nun Seven is absolutely perfect.
Well, his wife died. Yes. Mm. So,
and he's there's a certain. I mean, there is a quiet dignity which, as British people, I think we can identify with about the way that a Nun Seven goes about his business. And ice in his veins. He's clever. He's shrewd. He's ruthless. But at the same time, he has that air of procedure and politeness and protocol, which is quite chilling when you watch our own politicians.
Yeah.
And particularly when you watch British politicians, or shall I say, I'm going to say English politicians, do their thing. It's quite unnerving to watch in that context, watching it quite recently. I mean, when you're a kid watching it. But now, when you're having to record a podcast and come up with opinions, you're thinking, bloody hell, this episode. But I wanted to quickly talk about something else, which I think is quite a big thing.
Yeah.
And that is General Order 24. Holy shit. Yeah. They have a General Order 24.
Yeah.
So the Enterprise is not only an instrument of peace and exploration, but it's a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, yes, damn straight, yeah.
And everyone's quite happy to actually go along with that as well.
Yeah. There's Scotty up there.
Scotty up there, programming in where all the cities are, where everyone lives. Yeah, everyone's going to get absolutely, like, phased out of...
I mean, one high point of this episode is when Scotty calls down to the planet very, very calmly and very authoritatively tells them,
all cities and installations on Eminiar 7 have been located, identified, and fed into our fire control system. In 1 hour and 45 minutes, the entire inhabited surface of your planet will be destroyed.
And it's really chilling. And I've also liked the way that Uhura turns around and looks up at Scotty in a kind of look of shock.
Mm.
But she must know what General Order 24 is.
Yeah.
Or maybe she doesn't.
Mm.
Maybe she's not command rank. Mm-hmm. She's never had to take command and doesn't know what General Order 24 is.
Mm.
Because she was shocked. She looked up at Scotty in genuine dismay as a kind of, you're going to... What? We're going to what now?
Mm.
Maybe it's not something that only... Maybe it's something that only command rank people know what it is. Which I find that hard to believe because...
Maybe it is something that is like, you know, the mutually assured destruction thing whereby you say, well, look, we've got the power to destroy everyone and we will do it. And we won't do it all in one go. We'll probably hit a non-populated area first. But we will just...
We'll keep going until you tell us to stop.
General Order 24 is probably something like that.
Well, I thought it was going to be a bluff code, you know, one of those...
Well,
so they would say a number, and it's actually, we will sort of, like, broadcast some...
The Spice Girls.
Yeah, the Spice Girls. You know, which is just worse than death, I suppose. Everyone jumping into those suicide booths straight away.
Oh God, it's been disrupted already.
This one's broken.
So that was it. When it did sort of, as the episode went, well, near the end of it, no one's actually got a smile on their face that they're actually playing a joke on them. And actually, it is a real Order 24 that it will be a military action.
Because Kirk says, doesn't he? He says, you know, if you don't hear from us in 10 minutes, if we're not being up in 10 minutes, I'm going to resolve this issue in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, then, go ahead and kill everyone.
But what does that say about the character Kirk there? Because the thing is, this is a different character.
This is a different Kirk, isn't it?
You know, he's willing to jump in with to fix something, you know, to fix something, but he doesn't know how he's going to do it in one respect. I mean,
he is going in absolutely blind into this episode, isn't into this scenario, into this.
Yeah.
He's going, right, I'm going to end this. His first thought is his
blind and firing, crew. Isn't he?
Yeah. He puts his crew above absolutely everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On that planet. Right, as far as he's concerned, they are, yeah, right from the off. Yeah, yeah. Now there is a balance to be struck between a commander who is responsible for his crew, but there's another balance to be struck between someone who places their lives of his crew above other people.
Yeah,
and that's weird. I don't know how Star Trek-y that is. I've got to say that doesn't strike me as being a very nice thing.
Yeah, there is another nice point of a recurring thing that we've picked up on is about how cheap life is. In the original series, especially in Starfleet, but also appears to be cheap as well for Federation diplomats as well.
I know, that guy.
That guy gets shot, and Fox just stops.
Fox just stops. Look, I mean, he furtively looks around a bit, but he goes, "Yeah, no, fuck it." And he's like, you know, we never find out who this guy is. I mean, he is the diplomatic red shirt.
He is.
I mean, he should have been wearing a
gray suit, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he's just like, oh god, I'm gonna die.
Yeah.
But he does sort of fold up into the corner. Yeah. Like, I'm just wondering, is he alive?
We get a female red shirt in this one, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yeah. And she doesn't die.
She doesn't die. But she gets a line. Ah, yeah, she doesn't deliver it particularly well, but she does.
But also, she does stand very prominently. So, like, you know, I'm gonna.
Yeah,
you know,
she does.
I'm in business. Yes.
Yeah, Miko Mayama plays Yeoman Tamara.
Yeah.
To give her her due, she has a red link on her on the Wikipedia page. Mm-hmm. So I think she has a stub on Wikipedia. I don't think it suggests she hasn't done much. The other female character is Maya 3, of course.
I found that
Barbara
very...
Babcock, who is an alumnus for Star Trek. She's done other things as well.
Seven episodes, I think.
Yes.
Mainly voice appearances.
Mainly voiceovers, Trelane's mum. Yeah, we have to describe Gothos in which she's Trelane's mum. Yeah. And other things. I think she also does turn
she's
up.
She's the cat in Assignment Earth.
Yes.
And but she's in Plato's Stepchildren.
And she's in Plato's Stepchildren. Thank you. Yes.
I thought it was quite funny. The time that you're introduced to her and Kirk at the same time, it's like goes straight into the soft focus.
Oh, every time she's on, she's
and then just waiting for that to come up again. You know, as it, each time she's having a conversation with him, it just soft focus.
Her costume though. Is something else, isn't it?
Yeah, down the side.
I bet Gene had tremendous fun testing that, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was quite well known.
Yeah, and you can tell as soon as she turns up and like Kirk goes immediately, on my planet because he's kissing.
Indeed. Just actually on the matter of the dead diplomat, whose name we never knew, the unknown diplomat. Who still lies there to this day? the tomb of the unknown diplomat. There he is. There is Fox himself, who is he's not the first example of a common trope, but he is a classic example of a common Star Trek trope. And that, although he's not an admiral, and that is the badmiral, that anybody who enjoys a rank above captain or anyone that a captain has to report into is basically an idiot, or as you eloquently said,
a dick.
Yeah. And this is quite well known. Robert Fox, an interesting character, Derek.
He's an unusual character that I think in Star Trek, well, early Star Trek, in that usually we see military figures, and he is of the political class. I mean, he is a diplomat. He's not like an admiral or a badmiral.
He's a Federation ambassador.
Yeah. Mm. So he brings a different sort of feel to it because he's he starts off very sort of like pompous and arrogant, and his duty and his responsibilities and his orders are actually higher up than a military expedition like we have here, and obviously he has a lot of disregard for the lives of the people on the Enterprise, which is completely different from the sort of Kirk's opinion and also Scotty's opinion. And we also throw in someone else here, which we have a little bit of, but I think actually McCoy actually plays, has some interesting sort of lines that could have been filled out a bit more, or an interesting take, because he actually plays, even though it's very small, the everyman in this. Because you've got like the government and you've got the military in this, and then you've got like, to a little bit of extent, you've got Scotty as a military everyman. And then you've got McCoy as the everyman who's trying to say, we've got to do something about this. You know, there's something, you know, something wrong. What do we do? You're the experts. What do we do?
This is actually the first time there is a reference made to the United Federation of Planets.
Oh,
okay. In this episode.
In full. It's referred to as the Federation.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I think what you see here is a more familiar role of government and military, mm-hmm. whereby you know, the military is just basically doing what the government wants it to do.
Yeah.
And so this is, instead of like the Starship going out and being a mix of diplomacy and...
Police action.
Gunboat diplomacy.
And they're also supposed to be...
It is something that is...
Explorers as well.
Well, that's what that's what ostensibly they're meant to be, but
I mean, they're supposed to be... I mean, it's the messages are never entirely clear.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in Star Trek Beyond, although that's in the Kelvin universe, but they reinforce the notion that Starfleet is non-military. But that's the one of the reasons why they got themselves into this bother in the first place, is because Starfleet is non-military. But we have seen plenty of instances mm-hmm. where, frankly, throughout the interfranchise, where that doesn't really ring true.
General Order 24.
General Order 24 being chief among them.
Yeah.
And this episode being chief among them.
You think, though, that being a diplomat in Starfleet is a very ageing process, because the guy who plays Fox is actually younger than us in that.
Oh, he's got some great...
Oh, really?
But he's got...
Gene Lyons. I believe
he's I think he was 42, I think.
Was he really?
Something like that. He was in his early 40s then.
Bloody hell. He's got bags under his eyes.
This is a man who's...
Was that makeup?
It was very good. I can't believe they were going to reproduce those bags under makeup. That was cinema quality, if it was. He is a very interesting character, but it is interesting how he sort of comes around. I mean, this is a very fascist episode, actually, because by the end of it, you know, Robert Fox is completely bought in with Kirk's plans. I mean, I watched him quite closely towards the end when Kirk is carrying out his plan. Mm. And when he asks Fox to take them all outside, take all of the captured councilmen and assorted useless security guards outside, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and Fox scowls at him, because I think Fox knows that Kirk's going to do something really foolish and undiplomatic. Mm. But he completely does what he's told. Yeah. By this point, he's subsumed, the government has subsumed to the military and is now taking orders from the military.
Yeah.
So that's the journey that's come along here. And we as viewers are encouraged to feel that this is a good thing because Fox is such a dick.
Yeah.
And now he's no longer a dick because he's taking order from Captain Kirk, who is the real dick.
I mean, I think it works out that way because Kirk is the star of the show, so he has to deliver. He delivers a really good speech. I mean, that's one of his better ones, isn't it, really?
All right. It's instinctive. Well, the instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands. But we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. Knowing that we're not going to kill. Today. Contact Vendekar. I think you'll find that they're just as terrified, appalled, horrified as you are. That they'll do anything to avoid the alternative I've given you. Peace or utter destruction.
That's that one. That is a brilliant line. And it's a great little speech. And it's not all pompous and everything, but he's actually really delivered really well.
It goes back to what I was saying. Well, one, that speech is consistent with the Roddenberry vision, mm-hmm. the pacifist vision.
Yeah.
Because it's weird. There is a pacifist streak in this episode because it is about the horror of war.
Yeah.
But it also tells us about people's conceptions of state as well. Perhaps unknowingly tells us about people's conceptions of state. But also it speaks to what I was talking about, I think the last time we were here, talking about Shatner's nuanced performances in the first season of Trek and how he becomes more of a caricature of himself later on in episodes. And it's another great performance, again, by Shatner, who, as you would expect, is very much the star of the show. Guys, is there anything else you want to say about A Taste of Armageddon?
Well, I'm sure we could talk for hours on it, but I think we should...
You should wrap up.
Yeah,
not I agree, actually. We'll ponder this episode, I'm sure.
Yes, we'll talk about it when we're on our way down to the football later on this afternoon.
Yes.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, I would imagine. And we'll be talking about another similarly themed Star Trek episode. We're going to talk about the Doomsday Machine in our next episode of Whom Pos Destroy. So we hope that you will listen to that. Right, so thank you very much for listening. Whom Pods Destroy is our website. Our Twitter handle is on there, and our Instagram is on there, and ways of getting in touch with us. Our email address is on there. I'm not going to go through it all now. Just go to Whom Pods Destroy as our web, and all of our information is there. You can also subscribe via iTunes or your podcatcher, where your where a favourable rating would be very welcome indeed. And if you wanted to share this podcast with your frenemies and enemies and frenemies, then by all means do. But I think that's it. Thank you very much for listening. From myself, Terry Fellon, from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.